Well, here we are in Revelation 21, page 881 in our church Bibles. It was while waiting in the doctor's surgery several years ago now that I thumbed through a back copy of a Reader's Digest. And I discovered the following made-up story. An old couple in their mid-80s died in a car crash. They'd been in excellent health, largely because the lady had insisted on a good diet and plenty of exercise. But in a moment, the couple were transported out of this world and came face to face with heaven. As they were being shown something of the glory of heaven, the beauty amazed them. And the man said, "How much is it going to cost for us to stay here?" And the answer came back, "Don't worry, it's free." And they were shown the famous golf course. And the man again, astounded, said, "How much are the green fees up here?" And the answer came back, "You play for free." Then they were shown around the restaurant, which was beyond imagination, and they asked about the price of the food, and they were told, "It's okay, everything is free." "Well," asked the man, "where are the low-fat dishes and the low-cholesterol sections?" And the reply came back, "You can eat whatever you like here. There is no danger and no dying." At this, the old man flew into an incredible rage. He threw his hat down on the ground. When he calmed down, he turned to his wife and said, "This is your fault. If it hadn't been for all those bran muffins, we could have been here years ago." Now, I repeat that fictitious story because it raises the real question. Is it possible that heaven is more wonderful than we have ever really considered? Is it possible that arriving in heaven is more important than anything else in the world? And of course, the answer to both questions is absolutely yes. As you heard those words read just now. Can there be anything more remarkable in all of literature? He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain. So as we come to the final sermon in this series, All Things New, we've saved the best to last. We've looked at the new creation, the new covenant, the new song, the new family, the new hope, the new commandment, the new identity, the new ambition, the new life, and the new heart. Each have been signposts pointing us forward to their greatest fulfillment, to the time when God, seated on the throne of the universe, will say, "I am making everything new. Every dream made new. Every disappointment made new. Every longing, every heartache, everything new." A new world. So, in our imagination this morning, we're going to heaven. Maybe it takes a giant leap for us to get there, for we live in a society that loudly proclaims this world is all there is and all there ever will be. That pervasive materialism has produced a culture characterized by a profound loss of ultimate hope. It was Woody Allen who dryly said, "The future ain't what it used to be." Those utopian dreams have been shattered on the rocks of war, poverty, eco-catastrophes, and health epidemics. The golden age promised by science and education and technology has not arrived. The Marxists got it wrong with their vision of a classless society. The humanists got it wrong with their mirage of human perfectibility, and the liberal elite are mistaken to think that the whole world will bow down before Western-style democracy. Consequently, we are the disillusioned generation. We trusted the politicians, and then there was Watergate. We trusted the generals, and then there was Vietnam. We trusted the scientists, and then there was Chernobyl. And now we don't know who to trust. And so to that corrosive pessimism, the Creator God, who's largely been removed from the picture and whose truth has been dismissed as irrelevant, says, "I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will make all things new." Three things this passage says that in particular God will make new. Firstly, in verse 1, a new environment. "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea." A new earth. That's important. The biblical Christian view of the world to come is not of a timeless, matterless eternity where we exist in a vague spiritual state, floating on white fluffy clouds, plucking non-existent harps forever. The future will exist in a physical environment. Our destiny is not to be separated from a material world. God will renew creation and not bin it. He will bring into being a new earth and a new heaven. The great Christian hope, my friends, is not the immortality of the soul, but the resurrection of the body. We will have bodies patterned in some way upon the body of Jesus. The physical Jesus who appeared to the disciples after his resurrection, recognizably human, capable of eating breakfast on a beach, as well as materializing and dematerializing in a room with locked doors. We will have human faces, human hands and feet. We will know each other in heaven. The resurrection of Christ is the guarantee of the renewal of the whole physical universe. It will be an environment in which the wolf will live with the lamb and the leopard will lie down with the goat. On that day, creation itself will be liberated from decay. There will be a new order of physical reality. Now, what this new environment will look like exactly in every instance, we can't determine with precision. But we have enough clues in the Bible to know that there will be some things that are the same in that new world and some that will be different. The universe we inhabit now and the one we will inhabit then will have some overlaps and it will have some changes. When we use that big Bible word, salvation, we need to understand that God's agenda is more than the salvation of our souls, a kind of moral rescue package. God intends to redeem our mental and physical well-being. He intends to renew the natural order, to bring creation and the cosmos back into harmony, to restore a broken world. So that's the first new thing that God will bring about, a new environment. It'll be so new that according to that first verse, there will no longer be any sea. So, no blue planet? Is that what the writer means? That in the new earth, there'll be no equivalent Pacific to sail across or Atlantic to fly over? We always need to be careful of over-literalism in the Bible, and especially when dealing with the highly unusual language of Revelation. In ancient Jewish thinking, the sea was regarded as the hostile, untamed environment which kept humanity at a distance from its creator. It was the last great wilderness. The Psalms speak of the roaring seas in this way as a barrier to knowing and enjoying God. So what John is saying is that in this new environment, what once kept us apart will be removed. The moral distance will be eliminated. There'll be nothing now to stop that intimate connection between God and the new world. Eden will be restored. So, what does the prospect of a new world do for us right here, right now? Well, that vision of a future glorious new world, inspires Christians to make a difference in the present. You see, if this is what the kingdom will look like then, we are not just to pray, "Thy kingdom come." We are to seek to live out the values of that glorious horizon in the workplace and marketplace and leisure place. For sure, we know that only God can make things new. Evangelical social concern doesn't try to do what only God one day will do. But we don't have to wait for that new world to arrive before we seek to reflect and live by it. Think about it in this way. What motivates our concern for the environment? It's not just the fact that creation is good and that we've been given the responsibility to care for it, but also that creation itself will be renewed. There's a new world coming. What drives us to campaign for trade justice? To respond to the evils of human trafficking, to argue for the rights of the unborn and the dying. It's not just that we are made in God's image and that life is sacred, but that we are made for a better world than this. We are captured by a vision of the future. And every time we see that future denied in the present, we long for its arrival. Listen to this beautiful prose from Nicholas Walterstorff, professor of philosophy at Yale, as he reflects on Jesus' statement, "Blessed are those who mourn." The mourners are those who have caught a glimpse of God's new day and who ache with all their being for that day's coming, and who break out in tears when confronted with its absence. They are the ones who realize that in God's realm of peace, there is no one blind, and who ache whenever they see someone unseeing. They are the ones who realize that in God's realm, there is no one hungry, and who ache whenever they see someone starving. They are the ones who realize that in God's realm there is no one who suffers oppression and who ache whenever they see someone beat down. The mourners are aching visionaries. Martin Luther King was an aching visionary when he had his famous dream of racial equality and social justice. That's what William Wilberforce was when he campaigned for the abolition of slavery in the 19th century. That's what we are. Whenever we look at this world through the eyes of Revelation 21, we see a new world coming and we long for its arrival. But this vision of the future moves in the text of Revelation 21 from the global and the cosmic to take on a more domestic, we could almost say homely shape from verse 2. And so our second head from this new environment, we have a new home. Verse 2, I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. You see what the writer has done? He has merged in his language two images. On the one hand, there's the image of the completion of a magnificent building project, the holy city. This has been the desire of men and women of faith down through the ages. The book of Hebrews contains a hall of fame in chapter 11, and hanging there are the portraits of some of the giants of the faith who lived in hope of that eternal city. Here's how the writer of the Hebrews puts their life perspective. They were longing for a city. They were longing rather for a better country, a heavenly one. For a city with foundations whose architect and builder is God. Now, later in our chapter in Revelation, the scale and the dazzling beauty of that heavenly city is given more color. Listen to this from verse 10. And he carried me away in the spirit to a mountain great and high, and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. It shone with the glory of God, and its brilliance was like that of a very precious jewel, like a jasper, clear as crystal. And that idea of the clarity and purity of this new home is explored for us in the following chapter. So let me borrow from what's to come in chapter 22. And verse 1, then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, as clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb down the middle of the great street of the city. On each side of the river stood the tree of life, bearing 12 crops of fruit, yielding its fruit every month. And the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. Now, we don't need to understand town planning to get what's being said there. Those are pictures, symbols, images that act as glasses which focus on the truth as we look through them. The truth is that heaven is the home where all our needs are met. The river of life flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb. We are living at the very source of the life-giving stream. We're right there drinking it in. The river of life supplying all the needs of those who live there forever. Now, we can't say that about this life. Even with its many blessings and joys, this world disappoints and frustrates us. Our greatest moments, our deepest friendships, and our most powerful experiences leave us thirsty and wanting more. There's so much incompleteness
wherever we look. You see, sooner or later, one asks, even of Shakespeare, even of Mozart, even of Beethoven, is that all? Is that it? And so the writer says, the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. For this home is a place where all our wounds are healed. Again, that's not true of this world, but it's true of the one to come. Nobody hungry there, nobody disadvantaged there, nobody ill there, nobody cold, nobody lonely. The healing of the nations. So that's the first image, the building, the new home. The second image is that of the celebration of a glorious wedding, the marital home. And I saw the new Jerusalem coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. This holy city is preparing for a wedding. The new Jerusalem is betrothed and given away. What we witness there is a marriage. The church, the bride of Christ, bought by his death, saved by his life, made holy by his spirit, is ready. The believing church, his by grace, forgiven and loved, now finally belongs to him forever. For this is a marriage made in heaven, paid for on earth at the cross, and consummated in that new world. And the picture of the wedding gives us our third and final new reality which God brings about. The language of a bride and a wedding sets up in verse 3 a new relationship. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. It stands to reason that there can't be a new world unless there's a new relationship between God and humanity. This is where all the effort and energy to save the planet misses the point. We can't save the planet unless we can rescue man from himself. And only God can do that. You know the storyline of the Bible? It begins with man and God together at home in the world, in Eden. God walks in the garden in the cool of the day, but the relationship is broken. Paradise is lost. From that time on, a relationship with God would have to be now at a distance, exile. His presence now available only through visions, the words of visionaries and prophets. It was carried symbolically in the Ark of the Covenant and suggested by the temple. God with us, yes, but not actually present. So from Eden through exile. But then comes Christ and the new day, Emmanuel, God with us, but only for a time. The relationship is restored as Jesus offers forgiveness, acceptance, and entrance into the kingdom of God. But it's not yet complete. And after 3 years, it's interrupted. Jesus returns to heaven. He tells us to wait. He leaves us his spirit and the promise that he would come back. Now, press the fast forward button to our passage this morning in Revelation 21. And here is the fulfillment of the promise of Jesus. For now, at the end of the biblical narrative, the circle is complete. Eternity. God himself will live with us forever. We will enjoy the immediate presence of God. And when God is with us, notice what happens? All that spoils and destroys and ruins will be erased. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. Every tear wiped away, no more suffering, no more death, no more funerals. This, you see, is truth for the gravesite. I am never so glad of it than when I stand alongside those who are mourning the death of a loved one. This future hope doesn't make their grief and tears unnecessary, but it does transform them, offering ultimate meaning to our grief. Every funeral I have officiated at here in Highfields has moved me in some way or other. And after nearly 19 years, I've had a few. There is no such thing as just another funeral. Of course, there are standouts for me, like those of some of the large characters of our Highfield story. People such as the Jones sisters and John Dart and Hevin Elias. But there's been something profoundly challenging about three funerals in particular I've taken. Maybe it was their age that raised the emotional stakes for me. An undergraduate, Owen Best, who died suddenly and inexplicably. Though I never knew him, to bury him at Thornhill, surrounded by hundreds of his 18 and 19-year-old contemporaries from the university and Ysgol Glantaf, that was tough. Then there was Joanne Williams, who I did know from her earliest days as a toddler, in fact, to her last days in ITU, aged 33, was it? Jo, who fought so bravely and with such dignity the lung infection which eventually killed her. And those of us who knew him will never forget Pete Rees, the rugby-playing accountant whose last years in his 30s were lived with MS in a wheelchair and finally unable even to speak. These are the stories over which particularly I have whispered defiantly from the depths of my own sadness, God will wipe away all tears from their eyes. There will be no more death. I could not do what I do and see what I have seen without that vision of hope, without the truth that Jesus Christ is the resurrection and the life, and that whoever believes in him will live even though he dies. I don't know what Pete Rees and Joanne Williams are doing right now in heaven, but I can tell you one thing. Pete is not in a wheelchair, and Joanne is not wired up to a life support machine. They are more alive now than they ever were. So it is to the ultimate issues of life, in all its fragility and sometimes deep mystery, which passages like this one speak to us with such force. Let me, as I land, apply this truth in two pretty different ways. Both can give us the perspective we need when dealing with life in our broken world. Firstly, the false impression, which can sometimes be given by those who say that we can have it all now, that the benefits of heaven are entitlements almost today. Prosperity and blessing, health and wealth are ours to claim. Just speak out the word of faith. This emphasis is dangerous because it can lead to living in denial in the face of realities. And also, we have such limited answers and ability to deal with hardship and suffering when it comes. The fact is, we are not yet in the world of Revelation 21. So we will continue to feel the impact of pain and loss and suffering. Therefore, we must not pretend to feel now what we cannot feel until heaven. We were designed to enjoy a better world than this, but until that better world comes along, we will groan for what we do not yet have. But let me flip it, because this passage also speaks to a Christian view which tends to an unnecessary pessimism, that we have it all later, that we just need to accept the present, screw up our eyes and wait for heaven. Friends, that's not true either. The Bible presents God as making a number of significant new starts in this world. For in the death and resurrection of Jesus, God has already begun his new creation building project. We have his Spirit now. We have a new identity in Christ now. We have new life now. The forgiveness of sins now, the possibility of change now, the privilege of a new family now, the hope of heaven now. None of these in their fullness, of course. None of these completely, of course. There is more. much more to come. But God has started. And what he has started, he will finish. So yes, we do face difficulties, but in them we can experience the grace of God. Troubles come, but so does the comfort of the Spirit. Sadness beats a path to our door, but that is mingled with the joy of Christ. Unmet longings overshadow us sometimes, but we can still trace the rainbow through the rain. When the new millennium was celebrated all around the world and the media covered some of the great capital cities, the cameras focused on an unusual sign which appeared in large letters on Sydney Harbour Bridge. It was the word eternity. There, among the fireworks and the neon lights and the number 2000, was a reminder to the world of a bigger world beyond this. In fact, the story behind eternity was that the city of Sydney was honouring an unknown homeless man. And for the previous decade before his death, he had simply traipsed the streets of the city writing and painting and daubing in graffiti that single word, eternity, everywhere he went, on pavements and walls and underpasses and buses and trains and windows. Eternity. As if to say to anyone who cared to look, there's more to me, there's more to us than meets the eye. There's more to life than this. You know, when I heard that story, I got to thinking, what words do we write upon the lives of those we walk and work amongst? If the city of Cardiff were to honour us, what letters would they spell out on the roof of the Millennium Centre? What's my legacy word? How much does the prospect of heaven bleep, like an internal sonar device, pulling me forward to the new world? Maybe that anonymous Australian was simply repeating what the author of Ecclesiastes wrote many centuries ago. God has set eternity in the hearts of men. Now, if that is so, am I living for eternity, for heaven, now? How much does that glorious future make sense of my present? The day when God will say, I am making all things new.